My topic for tonight was listed as democracy's transnational dilemma, which does stem a bit from my previous work on globalization, which relates to the idea that we are living at a time globally where democracy is at the same time more valued than ever before, while it is also more challenged than ever before. Right at the time that we see global democracy in some sense spreading around the world, it is also we're also faced with challenges that seem to challenges that outstrip the very institutions that we are familiar with that house our democratic governments, practices, and the like. Near the beginning of his essay on perpetual peace, Kant states that every nation must have a republican constitution, which for Kant meant that it must have a government characterized by freedom, the rule of law, separation of power. So something like what we understand as democracy, as opposed to despotism or dictatorship. So already in the 1790s, when democracy, as we know it today, was still very much in its infancy, there was an understanding of the connection between international peace and the development of something like democratic government in the domestic sphere. So there's this connection between democracy in the domestic sphere and international peace that interests me. So I'd like to take this time to talk a bit about the state of democracy today. And the possible future of democratic government in an age of increased transnationalism. And I'll try to explain a little bit about what I mean by that. But in order to say a few words about the future, I'd like to begin with a few comments on the recent past. And so I'd like to start with a few dates. 1989, the triumph of democracy. 1999 and 2003, the rise of global civil society. And 2008, the challenge of global crises. Maybe no one needs to be reminded, but last November marked the 20th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall. And last spring marked the 20th anniversary of the pro-democracy protests in Tiananmen Square, two landmark events in the history of democratic movements worldwide. While the events of Tiananmen Square in the spring of 89 certainly failed to bring about electoral democracy in China, they continue to reverberate. As we know, a hero of Tiananmen just won the Nobel Peace Prize. And the fall of the Berlin Wall in the autumn of 89 ushered in an extraordinary period culminating what political scientists call the third wave of democratization. By the end of the 1990s, electoral democracies had spread through Eastern Europe, Asia, Africa, and Latin America. And by 2000, Freedom House had counted 120 democracies, the highest number and the greatest percentage in the history of the world up to that time, leading some to see liberal democracy as having definitively won the great contest of history. We know that this is an incomplete story, to say the least. Simply holding elections does not make a government democratic. And we've seen how a number of countries have held elections while maintaining elements of authoritarianism. But in the course of history, it remains unique, the spread of democracy post-89. Ironically, though, around that same time that democracy appeared anyway to be spreading around the world, doubts about democracy's traditional forms also began to grow. Democracy was more widely accepted than ever before, yet confronted by the forces of globalization, nationally-based democratic institutions appeared to be increasingly overrun. While policymakers at the World Bank and key capitals of Europe and North America touted the benefits of free trade and deregulated markets throughout the 1990s, by the end of 99, a considerable anti-globalization movement had been spawned. Imagine we all remember that. protesters had paralyzed the World Trade Organization meeting in Seattle, decrying the injustices of globalized corporate capitalism. Globalization, it was argued, was not spreading democracy, as some supposed, but rather posing a mortal threat to it. The Battle of Seattle, as it became known, ushered in a series of transnational protests in Genoa, Quebec, here in New York. And some argued that if globalization challenges democracy at home, global civil society was the necessary tool for Democrats to respond abroad. Interestingly enough, it was not globalization that gave rise to the most significant instance of global protest, but rather the actions of the American president. On February 15th, 2003, across North America, Europe, the Middle East, Asia, and Australia, as many as 30 million people took to city streets on the same day to express opposition to the planned invasion of Iraq. We have an interesting reminder of that on the wall across the way. It seemed an extraordinary moment for global civil society, perhaps for the first and maybe only time living up to its name, a very clear global movement of protests and action. The anti-war movement appeared to accomplish in a single day what 4 years of transnational activism against neoliberal globalization could not. It brought together constituencies from East and West, North and South, into a broad-based movement with a common clear objective: stop the U.S.-led drive for war. The next weeks saw what was, in effect, a Pyrrhic victory, though, for global civil society. The protests, no doubt, contributed to the Bush administration's defeat in the U.N. Security Council, but they also contributed to a sense that the U.N. and global civil society were next to impotent, next to the extraordinary hegemonic military power of the United States. Bush made clear that the U.S. would do whatever it wanted, independent of global public opinion. Global civil society then seemed to constitute itself and reveal its limits at the same time. It sort of gained its identity, and at the same time it seemed to define itself as limited. Since then, with the continuing violence in Iraq, recent news has shown that violence is certainly not over there. The seemingly intractable conflict in Afghanistan, and now a very much weakened U.S. economy, the debate continues to shift from debates about globalization through fears about American empire to notions of multipolarity and the emergence or reemergence of new global players, punctuated by the events of August 8, 2008, 8808, as the lame duck U.S. President Bush, after his popularity had plummeted, as he watched the official arrival of China and Russia, watching literally on the same day as a spectator at the opening ceremony of the Beijing Olympics, and figuratively watching as a hamstrung bystander while Russia invaded Georgia, a U.S. ally. At the same time, events have proven just how important globalization remains. As we know, an enormous financial crisis with roots in the U.S. housing market has rippled across the world since 2008, and we're still feeling those effects. Most recently, perhaps, in the election on Tuesday. But the global economic crisis demonstrates both the challenge global forces have on national and even local institutions and the need for effective transnational responses. Democracy has become more widely accepted than ever before, yet confronted by global challenges, nationally based democratic institutions appear increasingly insufficient. Not only in terms of global financial crisis, but in terms of larger issues such as climate change, nuclear proliferation, the risks of globalized health pandemics, such as bird flu, in relationship to the sort of large challenges that are affecting us, and in relation to some of the ideas and discourses that are happening at the United Nations or among summit meetings for at the G20, where our presidents are meeting, and like the fundamental challenges that are affecting us today: climate change, nuclear proliferation, health pandemics. These are all things that, in order to respond to them, we can't do it as just a single country. Right? No single nation state can respond to that on their own. You need to cooperate. The question then for me, when I talk about the idea of democracy's transnational dilemma, is that there's no process underway that, when we're trying to grapple with these questions at a large scale, there's no process that makes some sort of democratic solution possible. Our democratic institutions are national or local or regional, maybe, but nothing as a larger whole. So, and this gets at the dilemma. This would seem to pose a dilemma, and that is, there's no mechanism available to challenge the will of the people on a global scale. Thus, it appears that we have to choose between democratic governance or some sort of larger global or transnational governance. We need global governance. We need transnational governance, or improved transnational governance of some kind. We want democratic governance. Are we forced to choose? I want to argue that that's a false choice, that we shouldn't have to choose. And in the past, I've written under this in the terms of popular sovereignty, but maybe I'll not go into that right now, actually. Well, the fundamental notion to me that's at the center of this question, this dilemma, as the rule of the people, and this is the definition of popular sovereignty, which I take to be central to the very idea of democracy. Popular sovereignty signifies that the people, broadly defined as you might want to define it, play a central role in the constitution, steering, and occasional transformation of the institutions that govern our lives and the laws that govern our lives. Globalization, then, these global challenges, presents extraordinary challenges to this very idea. Although I'm not making some sort of anti-globalization argument. I think globalization is actually, or can be, a very positive thing. It's a matter of making globalization and democratic practice compatible. But globalization and global challenges our understanding of democracy, because it can bypass the authority of the people by leading to the development of governing mechanisms far beyond our reach. It can undermine the consensual foundation of democratic authority by limiting the transparency of power. So this is sort of what I was just saying about it makes it very difficult for us to understand who's in charge, what are the institutions and mechanisms that have the most profound effect on our lives. As economic production and control become increasingly transnational, it becomes more and more difficult to communicate to the public information about who or what is behind the forces that determine or influence our lives. What does it mean when GM sells more cars in China than it does in the United States? What does it mean when currently one of the most talked about responses to American unemployment is the need to get Beijing, not Washington, to get Beijing to do something about their undervalued currency? So this seems to pose the dilemma. But I said I'd like to argue that it's a false choice. It's a false choice that we shouldn't have to choose between global governance and democratic governance. It's a false choice because we need better global governance, but in order to be effective, global governance has to be perceived as legitimate. And thus some form of democratic process of legitimation is necessary. Now, some would argue that effectiveness itself creates legitimacy, but I would argue that any effective governance over time requires oversight of some kind, public oversight of some kind. Thus, the task is to develop mechanisms for the legitimation of global governance, legitimation of our transnational responses to global challenges. Now, you might ask, what are the actual chances of accomplishing such a thing? And so what I'd like to do is just sketch out briefly three views of this question. An optimistic view, a pessimistic view, and then what is perhaps you might say is a pragmatic view. The optimistic view is that there are many opportunities. Optimistically, one can say that many recent developments augur very well for the development of democratic politics beyond the national domain. For one, technological advances in information technology make transnational communication of political ideas and identities, preferences and petitions increasingly realistic through the internet, satellite communications. These things shorten the distance between like-minded people and have the potential to reduce the opportunity costs of becoming politically involved. Technological advances also increase the capacity for immigrant communities, diaspora communities, to maintain their political connections that transcend the ties of territorially based political institutions and present opportunities for the development of transnational mechanisms of modern direct democracy through internet voting, virtual public spheres, and the like. This is the kind of things that were talked about quite a bit in the heady days of the late 90s when everyone was talking about globalization. But beyond such technological advances, political developments suggest a future when transnational politics will not be uncommon. The rise of interest in regional projects of various kinds around the globe suggest a readiness of national governments to accept that globalization requires cooperation. The European Union comes to mind, but also very importantly on the African continent, developments at the level of the African Union, but also regional institutions in Western Africa are very important as well. The pessimistic view, on the other hand, though, is that for each one of these opportunities, there are very many limitations. Pessimistically, one could argue that the technological advances are normatively ambivalent. They are tools that may be used by anti-democratic tendencies as well as democratic. We can see that the end of the Cold War certainly did not result in the end of history, with the triumph of liberal democracies the world over, by far. Populism, religious-based politics, authoritarian capitalism all represent strong anti-democratic tendencies in the world today. And while these regional projects we are seeing certainly have the potential for democratization in the future, currently they suffer from very well-known democratic deficits. The European Union, again, is furthest along, but its struggles over its proposed constitution and the Lisbon Treaty have showed still many, many people see this as an elite project. But I think the biggest limitation to the potential constitution of transnational democracy is that none of the principal actors involved, not governments, not states, not people, not citizens, and certainly not capital, can really be counted on to recognize any immediate interest in transnational democratization of power. A new level of regulation and oversight is always going to be antithetical to the libertarian instincts of capital. States, as the major actors in the international arena, have a strong interest in maintaining their legal sovereignty. Sovereign status remains the foundation of state identity in the international arena, and this will never be given up lightly. But perhaps most troublesome for the larger cosmopolitan vision is that peoples, citizens, who are often set to benefit the most from institutions of transnational democratic law and human rights and the like, peoples are often actually the most reactionary forces regarding notions of world community or transnational solidarity, international institutions. Popular opinion is often more nationalistic and parochial than that of political, social, and economic elites. And this was evident in the campaigns to reject the European Constitution in France and the Netherlands. And it's been very evident most recently in the wave of support for the Tea Party movement here in the United States. So we're left with the pragmatic view, which says we need to take things one step at a time. Pragmatically speaking, we're faced with a great range of challenges that require a certain amount of concentrating on the tasks at hand. Further crises and global challenges will require better global governance. Successful global governance requires legitimacy. And this will require a process of inclusion so that the governments and the peoples affected by the purview of governing institutions feel some sense of ownership. To be successful, global governance has to avoid being perceived as being imposed from abroad. Of course, pragmatism means we need to be realistic. We can admit that the United Nations, a place that I work very closely with, is, while the closest thing we have to a universal global governance system, it is not even remotely democratically structured. And any chance of reforms, certainly since 2005, is really very unlikely. Nevertheless, there are precedents to suggest that a democratization of responses to global challenges is a potentially fruitful endeavor. It's been widely recognized that popular participation in global civil society played a pivotal role in providing the momentum for the establishment of the International Criminal Court, and in the process that led to the Ottawa Convention that banned landmines, and also in the establishment of the UN framework on children and armed conflict. And most recently, in the wake of the global economic crisis, the widening of countries involved in the management of global economic affairs since 2008, from the G8 to the G20, to include emerging powers such as China, Brazil, India, South Africa, Turkey, among others, is certainly a positive development. However, less than the immediate idealistic overhaul of international institutions, the pragmatic view of transnational democracy would focus on strengthening popular sovereignty at the local and national levels, in communication with regional institutions and the networks of a growing transnational civil society in order to find the best responses to the worst problems. This perhaps doesn't sound like much, but I think the point is we are faced with a moment where it is becoming increasingly clear that transnational challenge require transnational solutions, and recognizing that such challenges cannot be addressed by go-it-alone politics means should not force a choice between democratic governance and global governance, but rather encourage a search for innovative, legitimate solutions to the practical problems that are common to all. Thus, the task ahead is to develop mechanisms to incorporate democratic deliberation into this process, to register the consent, dissent, fears, priorities, aspirations of all affected by the processes of transnational politics, to subject global governance to democratic authority as it is being constituted by authors, providing immediate responses to the demands of our time. The point is these responses are being constituted. that's happening. It's not something that we can say should happen in the future. It's actually happening. And the question is, how can we bring democratic voices into this process? This is, I think, an extraordinary challenge in itself. But I think how this challenge is met has great consequences for the future.